And we are on page 137. We are starting, therefore, at Luke chapter 10. You can see, if you do have the harmony, since there are no parallel columns, that this is material that is unique to Luke. But it's some of the most famous material that there is in 2,000 years of biblical history. The story of the Good Samaritan. Now, I'd be surprised if there are many atheists who do not know the story of the Good Samaritan. I'd be surprised if there are many atheists who have not used the story of the Good Samaritan as an example of how people ought to behave. It is universally accepted as a model of behavior that wouldn't matter if you were a Hindu, if you were a Buddhist, if you are Muslim, or whatever you might be. You know, here is an example of what human beings ought to do every day of their lives. And so Jesus tells the parable because of this lawyer in verse 25. A certain lawyer stood up and what? Put into the test. So Jesus is already confronting a dishonest man. He is confronting an enemy. He is being put to the test, not because the man has any honesty about him or interest, but because he thinks that he's so smart that he can test Jesus. The lawyers, the rest of the religious leaders of the time, to a man, were opposed to Jesus, with a few exceptions, I guess, Nicodemus, but they wanted him dead. We've been studying that week after week, statement after statement. They were already plotting to kill him. And so he stood up and he put him to the test. He thought it was his turn to try to put Jesus down. He said, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" Well, of course, cross the spectrum of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Essenes and the other different religious groups of their day. A lot of disagreement over all of that. And so he thinks that he can get Jesus in trouble with somebody for sure, you know, because no matter what he says, there'll be somebody that would be willing to argue the case against him. But Jesus says, "What is written in the law? How does it read to you?" So that answer, is it an answer at all? It's really not. What did he do? We have an expression I just really love and try to use it every chance I get. It's called, "Turnabout is fair play." You ever heard that one? So all he did was he said, "Okay, well, you answer the question, I will too. So you tell me, what do you think?" So Jesus knows his heart. We've had those statements as well, that he knows the hearts of all these people. He's exposed the iniquity within those hearts time and time again. So he just asks the guy, "Well, okay, you're a lawyer. What does the law say? How does it read to you?" Well, now he's on the spot, but he's a sharp guy. You got to give him credit. He's smart. And he answers apparently immediately. He says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." Now, I got to give this lawyer credit. He was well-armed, and he gave the absolutely correct answer. He also gave the answer that is, brethren, the core of both the Old Testament and the New. He quoted verses, and if you do happen to have the harmony, or likely in most of your regular Bibles, you may have a footnote or a center column reference or something like that. But at the end of verse 27, you'll see that there is, in parentheses, two references where you can find that statement. You can find that material in Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 18, and you can find it in Deuteronomy 6 at verse 5, and in the surrounding verses. And you'll note, of course, again, if you have the New American Standard, which I so highly recommend, that verse 27 has the statement in all capital letters. That's their device for showing you this is a direct quotation from the Old Testament. And then they give you the references, Leviticus 19:18, Deuteronomy 6:5. This lawyer is absolutely right. If you want to know what you need to do to inherit eternal life, then you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and, second, your neighbor as yourself. So, with your heart, your soul, your strength, and your mind, you are to love your God, and then your neighbor as yourself. Now, I don't mean to demean that second part, but it is a separate and second thing. With regard to the love of God, you will know so well, we've camped on this so very many times, statements that are found all throughout the Old Testament and the New. Is it possible to love someone and not act in their best interest? Now, if you're totally selfish, you're only doing what you want to do, you don't love that other individual. You love yourself. Is it possible to love God, your Creator and your Lord, if you refuse to do the things that He tells you to do? Lord, I love You with all my heart, with all my soul, with all my mind, with all my strength. I'm just not going to do what You ask me to. Is that love? That's not love. And once again, that's just rebellion and selfishness. I'd like to have You around, God, anytime that You line up with what I want to do. And then you get out of line, Lord. You and I are going to be part in company. Well, that's not love. It's not love by any stretch of the imagination. And so if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, as Jesus said in John chapter 15, 16, if you love Me, and I'm quoting now, if you love Me, you will what? Keep My commandments. So the lawyer gets that. I mean, he understands that that commitment would require keeping the law that he spent his life studying and that he's now representing. And then secondly, and I really don't mean in any way to minimize it, it's not any more easy or simple to do, I suppose. You're also to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, I'm here to tell you, I love me a lot. A whole lot. I love me more than you. Although, I do wrestle with that. I try to fix it so that I can love you as much as I love me. But it doesn't matter. Whatever you ask me to do, the first thought that goes through my head is what? How does that impact me? It doesn't matter. As a matter of fact, I'm getting ready for this third trip to Israel. You all know how much I love Israel. You all heard the story of how I got to Israel the first time. The woman who said she appreciated some counseling I did for her, without ever consulting me, sent me a check for $5,000. And she said, I know it's every preacher's dream to go to Israel, so here's your plane ticket and the cost of the tour over there. Go to Israel. When I got that check, how did I feel? It really irritated me. It really did. I had never wanted to go to Israel. It was just her imagination. I never said anything about going to Israel. I had no desire to go to Israel at the time. I developed one thanks to her, but I didn't have one then. And then I looked at this $5,000 check, and I thought, what, I'm going to go by myself? I'm going to leave my wife behind? So what did I have to do? I had to go spend $5,000 so I could take Donna to Israel with me, which is called a white elephant. I didn't want to go. And her free ticket cost me $5,000. Okay. Now, I can't possibly appreciate her more, and I've told her so over and over and over again. It's the greatest gift I ever received. I said, thank you. But at the moment, what was my first thought? How does this impact me? See, I wasn't thinking about her. I was thinking about me, to my everlasting shame, and I learned my lesson. Jesus is telling us, you love God with everything, and your neighbor as much as you love yourself. That means when anybody comes into your area, they get inside the perimeter, brethren. You're supposed to be thinking about them first. And so, Jesus answers verse 28. You've answered correctly. Good for you. You got your own question right. And do this, you will live. Now he asks, live how? Eternally. If you do this, you will live eternally. Now, in verse 29, look at the first five words there. What do you know the lawyer's feeling? He is not happy. He has been busted. He has been effectively defeated and shamed. He feels the need to justify himself. Now, brethren, unless you feel like you're on the losing end of something, you don't have any desire to justify yourself because you're already justified. So he comes up here, and he thinks he's going to show the world how to handle Jesus, and he fails so spectacularly, then he's embarrassed. So he sets about to try to redeem himself, to try to look good in everybody's eyes again. He wants to justify himself, so he says, you know, you can just almost see him stroking his long beard. And who's my neighbor? You know, he's so smart, we'll just take it to the next level. How many cases has he argued? You know, he knows there's going to be some back and forth here. So he's ready again. You know, hell, who is my neighbor then? And Jesus replied and said, a certain man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Now, before I go any farther, I think most of you probably already know, that's just one of, if not the most dangerous road in Israel in Jesus' day. It's about 14 miles between Jerusalem and Jericho. It's downhill all the way one way and uphill all the way the other way. And it's also through the wilderness of Judea almost every step. The wilderness of Judea is full of ravines and little valleys and all kinds of windy twistiness, you know, that this path affords. And consequently, it is just the robber's delight. There's 50,000 places to hide and jump out and catch somebody along that road. And between Jerusalem and Jericho, there's a significant amount of traffic. It's fairly wealthy traffic because Jericho is the winter resort of all Israel and has been for thousands of years. It was nicknamed long ago and in the Bible, the City of Palms. It is the City of Palms. And because it's also the lowest place on earth, and Dead Sea is it, and it's just a mile or two away, you know, it is excruciatingly hot in summer. Nobody wants to be there in the summer, but come winter, woohoo! You know, this is great. And so, in fact, Herod himself had a whole huge palace just in Jericho for him, and apparently that's where he died. And then had his body transported 14 miles so they could bury him up closer to Jerusalem in the Herodium. But here, everybody knows that road, and they know how fearsomely dangerous that this road is, and how if you're going to go down there because you got all the wealth and money you know to be going down to the resort and all of that, you better take a whole contingent of soldiers with you because now you're just prime pickings. Well, this guy's apparently by himself. He fell among robbers. They stripped him, they beat him, and they went off, leaving him half dead. And by chance, a certain priest was going down on that road. When he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise, a Levite, even the same tribe of the priest, but not necessarily a priest himself, but still the one tribe above all others that ought to know the law better than anybody else. And when he came to the place and saw him in 32, he passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan is universally despised by this lawyer and all the Jews. It was on a journey. And he came upon him. When he saw him, he felt compassion. He came to him, and he bandaged up his wounds. He poured oil and wine on him. He put him on his own beast, brought him to an inn, took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper, and said, take care of him. Whatever more you spend, when I return, I'll repay you. I'll put him on my bill. Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man that fell into the robber's hands? And he said, now, brethren, what else could he say? You talk about unjustified and caught with your hand in the cookie jar. This guy has just been caught again. Well, the one who showed mercy toward him. And Jesus said to him, go and do the same. Now, all Jesus actually said to this man was, do this, and you will live. And the man quoted from the Old Testament. Can't be wrong if you're doing what the Old Testament tells you to do. Then he said, go and do the same. Show the compassion even a Samaritan that you think is just a dog would, you know, do, and all be well. Lee.
I was just thinking as you were reading this, and I thought for many times, the act
there you are. Yeah, it's kind of the standard definition, at least in the Pacific Northwest, and thanks to Lowell Williams. Anytime you hear love is acting in the best interest of the one you love, and probably the one who said that has been influenced by Lowell Williams, whether he knows it or not. Now, Lowell may have picked that up somewhere else and, you know, passed it along, but since the 60s in the Pacific Northwest, that's been the standard definition as Lee just recited it.
That's where I got it.
And that's where she got it. Okay, you can't escape the influence of a very bright light. So that's it. You do goodwill toward the one you love. You do goodwill to God by doing what God asks you to do, and you'll be a well-pleasing child. And then you do what your neighbor needs, and you'll be well-pleasing in their sight too, as well as in God's. Go. They not only lack compassion, but they also lack courage. And Carol's absolutely right. You know, it could be a trap. It could be, you know, bait. Brother, do you have any choice but what? Find out. See, I'm sorry. So it's a trap. But you just can't leave people lying, you know, and dying by the side of the road. If that's what it looks like, then what? That's what it looks like. You're going to have to deal with it until you find out differently. Okay, so now we come to Luke chapter 10. As you can see, verses 38 through 42 is the next thing. Also unique to Luke, very bottom of 137 and spilling over on page 138 in harmony. But in verse 38, now as they were traveling along, he entered a certain village, and a woman named Martha welcomes him into her home. Now, we know from other places that this family lives in Bethany. Bethany would be just on the other side of the Mount of Olives from Jerusalem. It's maybe a 2 mile hike, and it's really simple and easy to do. You know, it's not far at all. The hill's not big to begin with, so if you want to leave Jerusalem, you can just go down the Kidron, up the other side, and down one more valley, and you'd be there. Or you can go around the end, you know, through the Kidron and the Valley of Gehenna, and wrap around. Either way, you know, Bethany's real close to Jerusalem. That's where this family lives. And so Martha says, come on in. Now, 39, she had a sister called Mary, who, moreover, was listening to the Lord's words seated at his feet. So Jesus teaching like he always does in this house, and Martha was distracted with all her preparations. She came up to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me. But the Lord answered and said to her, Martha, Martha, you are worried and bothered about so many things. But only a few things are necessary. Really, only one. For Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her. Now, you know, after we've just had a whole parable on compassion, I don't imagine that Jesus, you know, cuffed her on the left ear and then said, you know, why, dummy? You know, I'm the Lord. You ought to be listening to me. I think he was just as compassionate and kind, as gentle as he could be. But Martha, Martha, look at yourself. You know, you're all worried about all this. Is this the stuff to be worried about? Well, your sister picked the better part. She's right. You're wrong. Don't worry about it. So if lunch is late, what? It doesn't matter. And if the dishes don't get washed tonight, then what? I'm going to wash them tomorrow. Throw them away. Buy a new set. I don't care. You know, but Martha, Martha, you know, you're worried about the wrong thing. Now, brother, I just want to tell a little story. And again, 4.5 years, you probably heard this already. We recently finished a whole series on the church and on also church cooperation, how we are, you know, to behave with reference to each other, but also how we are to spend our money, what is wise and what is unwise, and what is scriptural and what is unscriptural, you know, and how we present ourselves to the world at large. Now, I was once in a congregation that was pretty well healed. They had 500 members and a really nice building. And they decided they were going to add on to this building. And they were going to build big kitchen, fine fellowship hall, put in all kinds of tables. They had room enough in there, you know, probably 300 people could sit down and comfortably eat. And so it's been, while Donna and I were there, that's where I met Donna. And while we were there, they did the whole building project, and I'll never forget the first Sunday that they opened, you know, the brand new kitchen and fellowship hall. We were going to have lunch after the morning assembly. During the morning assembly, and while we were trying to partake of the Lord's Supper, the smell of hamburgers had filled the building. And you could hear all the clatter and chatter from a whole bunch of women down there not eating the Lord's Supper while they were fixing ours. Martha, Martha. Oh my. That was one of those sort of seminal moments for me. I will never forget it. So here we were, trying to do the best we could to serve our God. And in the end, what we had was this terrible stumbling block temptation and problem that was causing people to not memorialize their Lord and the Lord's Supper, which is the reason we come together on Sunday morning above all others. And so, everybody up in the main auditorium, must have been 493 of us, you know, were up there. It was, they just made it so hard to concentrate on the Lord's Supper at that moment. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Be as compassionate as you possibly can be, and then choose the better part. And the better part, the most important thing there is to love God by learning what He would have you do, and then doing it. Do this, and you will live. Go and do likewise, Martha, as your sister Mary is currently doing. It's only a few things that are necessary. Now, we have some real fun here, because I set a schedule of trying to cover about 5 pages in the harmony per Sunday, so that we can finish at a point in time. You know, we've got things that are coming up. And we're just ever so slightly behind in that schedule. Today, we're going to catch up right now in about 5 minutes. And we're going to do it if you'll get your pencil in hand. Here's how we're going to do it. If you look in the harmony at Luke 11, verses 1 through 13, you would say to yourself, well, this must be material that only Luke tells us about, because there aren't any parallel columns for Mark, for Matthew, or for John. And so apparently nobody else said this. But that's not so. As a matter of fact, we have Jesus teaching the very same things on more than one occasion. Last Sunday, you saw me preach a sermon I've already preached here in the last 4.5 years, because it was key to starting a new series on the scheme or the plan of redemption. And so every preacher does this, and why not? As the people in the next town haven't heard it yet. You don't create something new everywhere you go. You just preach the good stuff. Everybody. So we've got this, and here's where your pencil comes in. What I'd like you to do is to make your little parenthetical grouping there for the first 4 verses, and then write in the margin, Matthew 6, 9 through 13, on page 67. Matthew 6, 9 through 13 on page 67. When we were doing the Sermon on the Mount, we already had this model prayer. This is a totally different time, but Jesus is teaching the exact same thing. So yeah, it's unique to Luke. He's the only one that tells us that Jesus did this on this occasion, and it's not, the Sermon on the Mount in Luke 11, but it's exactly the same material. Now, group verses 9 through 13. Because that's in the Sermon on the Mount too. That's Matthew 7, verses 5 through 11. That's on page 68, as a matter of fact. And then you go to page 139, and somehow, however you would do it, you want to group verses 14 through 24. Because Luke 11, 14 through 24 is Matthew 12, verses 22 through 30. That's on page 75. And then you want to group verses 24 and 25 and 26, because that's Matthew 12, verses 43 through 45 on page 80. And likewise, being very meticulous here, you'll notice I'm skipping a few verses, but group verses 29 through 31. They're now at the bottom of page 139. And that's Matthew 12, verses 39 through 42. So, in this case, Jesus rearranged the material some too. If you look at those pages, you know, you'll see it's the same material, but on this second sermon, Jesus put some of the points ahead of the other points the time he preached it the first time, so he's reworked it a little bit. It's identical, same material. Now turn the page, and you got to go fast here, and I'm only going to repeat, I'm only going to say it one time. I want to get past this, I want to get going on, but I want you to have it. So, verse 32 all by itself is Matthew 12, verse 41. On page 78. Verse 33, all by itself, is Matthew 5, verse 15, on page 64. And Luke 11, 34 through 36, those three verses, is Matthew 6, verses 22 and 23, on page 68. Now, I could get real specific, but in this case, I am not going to do it. So, just know that on page 140 in Luke 11, 37 through 54, everything you read there, save for the two verses, 40 and 41, but everything else, verses 37 through 49, you'll find in Matthew chapter 23. Just write Matthew 23. And that's on page 191. Now that's 50 pages ahead of where we are. So we haven't come to that material yet, but I want to save it for when Jesus preaches it at the end of his life. So I am not going to deal with all of this material in Luke 11, 37, and following, because Jesus will repeat it in the last week before he dies. We'll deal with it there. So then, look on page 141 at Luke 12. And in Luke 12, we'll come back to the missing parts, but in Luke 12, highlight or collect somehow, link, verses 2 through 9. 2 through 9. That's Matthew chapter 10 this time, verses 26 through 33 on page 95. And that last verse on page 141, that verse 10, that's Matthew 12, verse 31 on page 77. And then one more page of this. So on page 142 for Luke 12, verses 11 and 12, those two verses are Matthew 10, verses 19 and 20. That's on page 95. And the last one of these is verses 22 through 30. Luke 12, 22 through 30. Matthew 6, verses 25 through 32. And that is on page 68. Now, if you're wondering, why didn't you just print all this up and hand it to us? Because if I do that, probably a lot of you won't write it into your Bibles. You know, you'll forget, it'll get lost. There's a lot of reasons why you might not get it there. And I think it's really helpful if you just have it there. Then you can go and compare it later. You can put it in another Bible. You know, you got a hard copy. You know, it's a lot harder to lose than those sheets. So there you go. Now, that means we need to go back to page 138. We've already covered five pages right there all by itself. We're all caught up. You know, but we want to look at just what is unique to Luke entirely. And that would be in Luke 11 at verses 5 through 8 on page 138. So in verse 5 he said to them, Suppose one of you shall have a friend and shall go to him at midnight and say to him, Friend, lend me 3 loaves. For a friend of mine has come to me from a journey and I have nothing to set before him. And from his side he shall answer and say, Don't bother me. The door's already been shut. And brethren, that's more than we just shut our doors, you know. They had procedures for security's sake that they had to go through that we don't, because we got key codes and alarms and all that rest of that. So, you know, that's kind of a process for them. And my children and I are in bed, which often enough meant that the entire family was in bed because they didn't have enough money to have a second bed. Nobody had another room. So we're all together. We're down. Everybody's asleep. Go away. I'm not going to upset, you know, the whole household here for you. I cannot get up and give you anything. But in verse 8, I tell you, even though he will not get up and give him anything because he is his friend, yet because of his persistence, he will get up and give him as much as he needs. So, you know, if your buddy does not go away and you're trying to sleep, you just keep hearing this at the front door, like it or not, what's going to happen? You're getting up. It's not in your control anymore. So, what do we learn? Be rude to your friends and demand money at preferably 2 to 3 o'clock in the morning when it's the most possibly, you know, difficult time you can imagine. No, it's to be insistent. Obviously, persistence is what God wants us to understand out of this. So, you're persistent in every endeavor you have. It demonstrates you love the Lord your God with your whole heart, your whole soul, your whole mind, and all your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. You get up. Say, sorry, kids. Sorry, honey. But you got a problem. I'm going to have to give him some food. Okay, that means then that we can skip all the way over. Well, let's go over to the top of page 141. And we're going to look now at verses 52 through 54. 52 through 54. Woe to you, lawyers. You know, I'm sorry, I didn't get those for you, did I? I'm sorry, because I had them in the different margin, and so I missed it. Verses 50 and 51 at the top of page 141. 50 and 51. Those are in Matthew 23, verses 35 and 36. So they go with all those others on the previous page there in Matthew 23 on page 191. All right. So those we've already talked. But go to 52 through 54. Well, 52 is Matthew 23, 13. Sorry. 52 is 23, 13 in Matthew. But when he left there, the scribes and Pharisees began to be very hostile and question him closely on many subjects, plotting against him to catch him in something that he might say. So, when we started out with Luke chapter 11, see, we were dealing with prayer, persistence, and his being unhappy with these various Pharisees. And just before that, Jesus had been preaching the story of the Good Samaritan. These guys get it. Their lawyer hero has failed. They have failed. Everything they're doing is failing. And so they've already been plotting to kill him. It's just renewing that urgency. They're spending a lot of time now trying to figure out how to trap Jesus enough that they can put him to death. Well, of course, one day they'll just make it up and succeed in killing him. Now then, let's turn to page 142. And we're going to look at Luke 12, verses 13 through 21, and we'll be all caught up right where we want to be. In Luke 12, 13, someone in the crowd said to him, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me. And wash the dishes. Haven't we already done this once before? I think so. He said, well, it's the family inheritance. He said, Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter over you? He said to them, Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed, for not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. And he told them a parable, saying, The land of a certain rich man was very productive, and he began reasoning to himself, saying, What shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops? And he said, This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns, build larger ones, and there I'll store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to my soul, You have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease. eat, drink, be merry. God said to him, you fool, this night your soul is required of you. Who will own what you have prepared? So is the man who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. Now, obviously, we might have said Jesus dealt with that in other places as well. But the parable is just so wonderfully pictorial. This guy's got so much stuff he doesn't know where to put it. His barn can't hold it. And he's just looking at years ahead of just life is a bowl of cherries. So he speaks to his soul. Soul, eat, drink, and be merry. And the response comes down from God. This night, your soul is no longer yours. You fool. Focused on the wrong things. You're chasing after Martha's way of thinking about things. You're thinking about the way the Levite or the priest on the road to Jericho would behave. You got it all wrong. So if you're going to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength, and you're going to love your neighbor as yourself so that you can fulfill the entire law and spend eternity with life instead of death in the presence of God, then learn some things about compassion and forget some things about money and physicality and carnality and all those kinds of things. You got a beef with your brother about the inheritance. Jesus says, well, I'm sorry, but I got no interest in that. I'm not going to help you with it. Okay, comment or question? There you go, Carol.
It seems to me that this man isn't just reveling in his blessing. He's, number one, not recognizing that the blessing came from God, but number two, he totally quits. It sounds to me like, hey, I don't have to do anything for the next 10 years. So he's quit doing anything except for being with the world and enjoying life. He's not going to continue working and whatever is what I see with that.
Exactly. Whose mouth is going to eat and be drinking? His mouth. Nothing about anybody else's mouth. Doesn't matter how hungry they are. Who's going to be married? He's not throwing any parties for anybody else. He's throwing parties for himself. Okay, so you got it exactly right. The guy's just given up any concern about anybody else, the Lord or his neighbor, and he's just entertaining himself. He's got it all wrong. Okay, over here, yeah.
He wasn't thinking about the fact that part of the reason we work is to help other people. He's just thinking.
Exactly. Ephesians says that very thing. The reason we work is so that we will have to give to others. That's why we work. That's the way the Lord said we should anyway when you're in Ephesians 4. I'm not sure it's Ephesians 4, but it's Ephesians. Okay, anybody else? There we go. I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
Wasn't it Mary that, Martha that came when Lazarus died and she came out to Jesus and then she went back
to Aunt Mary? I don't remember the exact order, but you may be right on that. Both of the sisters will prove to be just as faithful as they can be. And their brother Lazarus will be raised from the dead. I'm thinking he was pretty appreciative too. Okay, so you're absolutely right. That's the same family.
We had Martha saved, at least from that one thing she learned.
Yeah, and like Nicodemus, gets it and comes around. Okay, see you in 10.